I think these are old issues that are being exposed. I think these are maybe old scars that are being ripped off. I do think that in a lot of ways, it's necessary to go through this phase to heal. And so I understand that if we want to better ourselves as a world, as a community, then we'll have to fight through some ugly moments. And this right now is one of them.
That's Jeremy Lin speaking to his mindset around surging anti-Asian violence, including last week's mass shooting in Atlanta. Today, we welcome him back to the show to talk about growing up Asian American, navigating the G League, and learning to embrace who you really are. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, March 24th. This is ESPN Daily. Jeremy, thanks for talking to me here today, man. I appreciate it, as always.
Thanks for having me. It's always good to chat with you, and feels like it wasn't that long ago, but I'm excited.
No, we had you on the pod in November, and Jeremy, I just want to be fully transparent here with the listener, because we first reached out to you in the wake of Atlanta, and Atlanta now is this noun that sort of means something very obvious to the Asian American community, and hopefully America in general. 8 people shot and killed by a gunman in 3 different massage parlors around Atlanta, 6 of them Asian women. And then, in further transparency here, we had another mass shooting on Monday, a gunman opening fire at a grocery store in Boulder, Colorado, 10 people dead, including a police officer who responded to the scene. So the question that I just want to start with here is simple. It's just, how are you doing, man, as all of this is unfolding around us?
You know, the tendency for me and everybody is just to, okay, what can we do? How can we problem solve? But even for me, it's reminding myself to slow down. And, you know, I think I had released an article that I wrote with my sister-in-law, but there's so many mixed emotions. But the first one is just like confusion and anger and just like, what is going on? And then it slowly it starts to get to, you know, a place of just, I can't allow myself to be like sucked into this vortex of negativity. I really do feel like right now I'm in a pretty good place in terms of just trying to accept some of the realities and cruelties of this world, and also to acknowledge that, you know, within the last few years, we've seen a lot of incidents or circumstances or whatever you call it that have made the world a lot more hostile, more tension, more polarization and division.
So I've been watching you, Jeremy, all month. Be everywhere on my television. I saw you talk to Anderson Cooper on CNN using your voice in the way you just described. I saw you on an NBC News town hall with politicians and activists. You live streamed with your brother about mental health. All of this stuff is startling to me because you're super comfortable and confident and open now. But I knew you before, man. You weren't like this. You are so much more at ease and public using your voice. Why is that?
First off, you know, it sounds a little scary that you've been watching me everywhere. You know, you need to, I don't know how I feel about that. You know, this is my 11th year as a professional basketball player. You've known me since I was a young pup at Harvard. I didn't know anything, and every stranger scared me, and every interview request made me uncomfortable. And
yes.
I think right now I'm getting to the point where, one, I think, you know, what we've seen is a lot of Asians and Asian Americans are kind of reaching a boiling point. And so I feel like, you know, I really do want to stand up, speak out. You know, it's the evolution of me as a person. You know, that's one thing that I wrote in this article and that it has been heavy on my mind is that when I was there at the height of global fame and spotlight in Linsanity, I didn't understand everything. I didn't understand systemic injustices. I only understood certain things, like when somebody wrote chink in the armor in the headline, or when somebody would call me a Chinese importer, or when someone would make fun of my eyes. I was like, that's racism. And that's all I knew. That's all I understood. Mm. And as I've gotten older, understood the world a little bit more, and have been educated, challenged by the people around me, I've realized, hey, this is much bigger, much more complex, and it requires more. And so I'm at the point where, hey, I want to help. I want to make a difference. And As everybody progresses through their life, it becomes about the next generation, and I'm thinking about the next generation a lot these days.
You wrote that piece for Time that you referenced with your sister-in-law, Patricia, who also works with you, and it was very unsparing, Jeremy, as it regards your view of yourself at the height of Linsanity, as you just alluded to. And when you look back now, and you wrote about this in the piece, how would you describe how you use the platform that you got overnight, suddenly, so suddenly, as an Asian American, as Asian American issues were concerned?
I think it was more lead by example and lead by what I'm doing, right? We weren't used to guards, Asian guards.
Yes.
And so just by blazing a new trail, that's the majority of what I did. I didn't do what I'm doing now, which is to be able to name and to be able to confront and to be able to talk through some of the issues that I see in society, and to even tie it into more real life issues in terms of politics and how it affects people, lives that are being taken. I didn't want to put my life on display, especially my mistakes and my mishaps and my failures. And that's part of what I'm doing right now, is that I know that if I want to be authentic, if I want to make real change, like, I also want to be real in terms of who I am and who I'm not and how I've made mistakes. And I think that vulnerability and transparency, I hope, will be powerful in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, look, the stereotypes that are out there about Asian Americans: we are submissive, we are studious, we are unthreatening, we are unathletic, we are ignorable. In so many cases, in so many rooms, it's the inverse that Black Americans are dealing with. So what we have is this model minority myth that is not only grounded in this sort of false depiction of our reality, but it's also super damaging in its own particular way. And it also involves us mostly staying quiet.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's something I touched on in the article, in the sense that, like, this isn't about Asian community versus Black community. And I think one of the things that my sister-in-law, Patricia, she wrote really elegantly in that, is that instead of having us pitted against each other, we have to recognize the system as a whole. And why is it that it's so hard for minority groups to get attention or to be heard? And why is it that minority groups feel like they almost have to compete against each other to compare experiences or to be able to talk and to be seen and to be heard? My parents were immigrants, and so playing basketball really shocked everything about what I knew. And so I only knew about certain cultures based off of movies. And then when I started to play basketball, I came in contact with so many different people, so many different ethnicities, and I became friends with them, and I would go eat with them. We spent Thanksgiving and Christmas together, and it was just like everything was shattered in terms of like what what I thought were the stereotypes and what people actually were. And it was beautiful to see, and that's only because of the game of basketball. Now imagine what everybody's thinking if they don't have those experiences and they don't have those friends.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, I'm first generation too. My parents came over from the Philippines, immigrants. I was the first one of my family born here. And what you're describing, Jeremy, resonates with me, because like part of being Asian American, I've found in my own life, it's this idea that making it in America means leaving your racial category to prove to other people that you're not what everyone said you were, that the stereotypes are not true. And I just imagine in sports, in your experience, that dynamic of wanting to prove that I am not the Asian guy you think I am, but now having years later to sort of be the Asian guy, that's a particularly complicated dynamic, right?
It's extremely complicated because, like you said, you come over, like I'm coming over onto every single court and I'm just like, please don't see my skin. Please don't see my skin. Just see what I can do so that you can respect me, so that I can be on the team, or so that I can get onto the court. And so I grew up running from that and being mocked for that, you know, and being always categorized and made fun of. Or I ran from that because I didn't think I would be respected for it, or because I didn't only want to be known for it. You know, the bamboo ceiling should not apply to this next generation. The model minority should not apply to this next generation. All the things that you thought, all the things that you used to get away with making fun of us or boxing us in, like, that you're not getting away with that anymore. And that's a big part of, you know, how this next generation and how, you know, my generation is feeling in terms of like, hey, this enough is enough.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of why I love talking about this now. And I had a similar trajectory, if I'm being totally honest here, where like you grow up and you're like kind of, I mean, fundamentally, the term is you're kind of ashamed. You're like, no, I'm not that nerdy kid. I'm other things too. But basically what you're sort of circling here is this very obvious reality now, to me at least, that words matter. And so as we are parsing and sorting through the documented increase in hate crimes against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in major cities, reportedly nearly 150% year over year, I'm curious how you feel about what we've been hearing from certainly former White House administration officials, politicians, that rhetoric around the coronavirus, around COVID-19. How accountable do you hold public officials for at least some of what we're seeing in that increase in violence?
If we're going to change anything, we need to start there. Mm. I mean, it's huge. And if you go back and you listen to the previous administration, you hear Trump saying Chinese virus or the China virus or the Kung flu, and you can hear all these people laughing and jeering and cheering. And that's just stoking the flame, right? And now we're still seeing it now with certain, you know, with senators and other things. I actually spoke to somebody yesterday who is 50 times smarter than me and very, very high profile and powerful. And actually that person said, like, if we're going to blame anything, if there's going to be one place that we have to tackle, it's the politicians.
So as those words had begun to be normalized under Trump, criminals who are also preying on the elderly, who are preying on women, Asian elders in particular, Jeremy, it's hard to know like the ultimate origin that sort of explains everything, but we know that this is also a thing that's happening that's profoundly scary. I mean, how are you feeling about your folks? Like, how are you feeling about them? Because I can speak for my own parents. I mean, I'm afraid. I'm in New York City. I'm afraid for them at times.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, you know, I'm glad because both my parents right now are in Taiwan. And, like, it's one thing when you read the headlines. It's another thing when you see the pictures. And it's another thing when you see the videos. And you can see some of these people who are just walking down the street, and it's not like they're premeditated. It's just, you know, and an Asian walks by, and then it's like they see red, and they just go crazy and attack, and it's like they can't stop themselves or they can't help themselves. Like, where is that coming from? Mm. Where is that coming from that you could hate somebody that you've never met, you know nothing about, and the only thing is their skin color? I mean, who here chose their skin color when they were born? Like, it's ridiculous, like, to just go and hate somebody so much because of their skin color. Like, it's mind-boggling.
Another thing, Jeremy, that you had mentioned before, you're not a professional activist. That is not your job. I am not a professional activist either. And it feels important whenever two people of any amount of celebrity begin to talk about this stuff to also direct attention towards the people who are doing the work. There's this balance, right, between I want to be a voice that matters and that is listened to and that promotes causes that are important to me. But also, we want to make sure that we keep the people who are on the ground doing the work central to the conversation. How have you found that dynamic? Who's impressed you in terms of people who are doing the work on the ground around these issues?
There are people who have spent their lives doing this, who have spent all their time.
Yes.
Like, I'm not talking 9 to 5, 5 days a week. I'm like 9 to 9, 6, 7 days a week, like putting their hearts and souls into it. And I mean, there are so many organizations on the ground. I mean, one that I've highlighted is Tribe TRYBE in Oakland. But you have Stop AAPI Hate. And even in the article that we wrote, like, we're always trying to link to different places and we're trying to work through different community organizations, because at the end of the day, they're the ones on the ground making a difference, not me. Mm. Those are the things, the active and practical things that people can do, because likes, comments, and like, oh, so-and-so is so great in that interview, that's not going to get it done.
Yeah, I mean, the history is so important, man. And this is where I should also be confessing some amount of ignorance, because I am currently like reading and researching myself as an Asian American. And there is so much stuff that I wasn't taught that I didn't know about. And it's even as basic as, oh, You go back to the 1800s, the Chinese Exclusion Act. What did that really involve? I mean, we've heard about Japanese internment, but we haven't heard about, like, Filipino people being imported to be in zoos. Like, decades upon decades ago, we haven't heard about all of these, the Vincent Chin story, right? Like, these are stories that even Asian Americans, I feel like, we kind of know a bunch about it, but if we only know kind of a bunch, you can imagine how little mainstream America really knows or even has ever thought about it.
You know, for me, actually, when I was in Atlanta playing for the Hawks, what we ended up doing was we took this course. We had a professor who was teaching us all these different things about the history of Asians and Asian Americans. And it was like so insightful and just like, man, how come I never learned any of this stuff? And you know, you can see that, like, even in the Transcontinental Railroad, it was like 90% was built by Asians. But then when they finished and put the last nail down, or when they finished the last piece, it was, and you look at the pictures and you look at the way that media had portrayed it and how it was just this remarkable thing to build a railroad that connected the East Coast to the West Coast. And there was not one Asian in the photo. There's not one. Mm. There's just so many ways that are like overt, like the Chinese Exclusion Act, and then very subtle too. And if you look at the history of how Asians and Asians are perceived and portrayed through movies and things like that too, it's just like, man, no wonder. And I find myself sometimes even like buying into it, you know, like growing up, yeah, it was like, yeah, I felt like I had to, like, you know, squint my eyes in social settings to fit in and be funny. And
dude,
it was like, oh, that's just what Asians do. It's like,
I know.
Oh yeah. Ugh. Like, do you want some Chinese takeout? Like, it was just like, when I was growing up, I was just like, I would fall into these stereotypes because that's all that was taught to me. And that's all I ever saw.
Yeah. I mean, because we wanted to fit in. I mean, that's the other key part about all of this, right? Is a defining feature I have found in the Asian American experience is that we are forever foreign. And so we are trying all the time to be considered finally as one of you guys, as American. And so the ways that we've been taught to do that through culture, by and large, has been to conform to these stereotypes, which when you look back on it now in the light of day, is so depressing. And I'm curious, Jeremy, like, now it does seem like there is a moment of unification in the Asian American community. And even the Asian American community, like that concept, I'm curious as to your perspective on it as to how it's evolved over the years, because it is a very diverse group of people who come from countries that are very different, very far apart, sometimes, oftentimes at war with each other. And so the idea that there's even like this monolithic Asian American, that to me has always kind of felt like a fallacy. But now there actually is this conversation around us that is drawing us together, which provides this moment, it feels like, that is unprecedented.
Yeah, and that's what I was kind of saying earlier when I was like, hey, look, Pablo, like at the end of the day, like, we're in a tough place, but it's a challenge and it's necessary in the growth of where we want to get to. You have to go through these times. And you think about in sports and basketball, it's like they always say, like, it's good to go through trials in the regular season because come playoff time or whatever. And so, like, there's this development or this challenge or this growth that needs to happen. And that's, like, for me, it's like, man, I need to do better. I need to learn more. I need to listen more. I just have to be better. The world needs me to be better. I need to be better. And, like, that's a big part of where I'm at right now. When immigrants come over, you know, like, my parents, it was like, we don't know how to, and we might not have the time or to be able to fight for all these social justice related issues. Like, I'm just trying to learn the language and I'm trying to like get a job and survive because I have nothing. And I came over here on nothing to try to make a living and to try to give my children a better future. And like, that's it. We have a lot more privilege because of the people that have come before us to pave the way for us. And it's beautiful to watch. Like you said, what you said in terms of like having all Asians being lumped into one, always did kind of feel like fallacy. But at the same time, it's like now we're actually becoming one.
Yes.
And speaking out as one. And that's what needs to be done. And then even beyond that, you know, the Asians are 6% of the U.S. population. That's not going to move the needle enough or as fast as we want it to be. So, you know, we're going to have to be able to learn how to ally with other people and other groups and to be an ally. Have I done enough to be an ally to other groups? No. I'll be the first to say that. I need to learn. And that's why I say, like, man, basketball did so much more than just on the court. Like, it changed me off the court and it gave me these relationships. It gave me these perspectives. But, like, even with all of that, like, I haven't been a good enough of an ally, and I need to figure out what that looks like and what that means. And so I need to have conversations. It's just starting by having conversations and pick up books and things like that. And so it's been great, man. It's been really challenging and humbling and convicting for me.
Okay, coming up, how Jeremy Lin wound up diffusing controversy in the G League and making peace with himself.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Yeah, I mean, look, you're 32 years old, and you're navigating the world of professional basketball in a way that is unique. It's singular. There really hasn't been anyone like you before. And so I want to discuss, Jeremy, how you played in the G League in a second here, because you dominated often, and I want to get to all of that. But I also want to just understand for the listener who hasn't been caught up on this, what happened to you in February? Because in February, another player on the court called you coronavirus.
Jeremy Lin, the first American-born NBA player of Chinese or Taiwanese descent who currently is playing in the G League, says he's been called coronavirus while on the court.
Part of that tradition of language that has become an unfortunate reality for a lot of Asian Americans.
His claim in a Facebook post spurred the G League to say it's opening an investigation.
But you decided that you did not want to publicly identify the player, which ultimately I did really respect as I thought about it a lot. I just want to understand your thought process there. How did you come to that decision?
To me, it's distracting. It's distracting, and it accomplishes not what we're trying to accomplish. And that's why it was important for me, like, for us to talk it out person to person, man to man, which we did, and which was great, and which was awesome. And that's why I'm saying, like, people are making me out to be a hero or a victim, both of which I'm a little bit uncomfortable. It's like, I'm not the real victim. Are you guys reading the headlines? Like,
right.
Those are the victims. But this happened to me to bring awareness to something bigger. And so if I'm going to sit here and talk about love, empathy, compassion, equality, and then it makes no sense for me to try to burn somebody, because what's going to end up happening is people are going to go after that person. And
yeah.
And that's what's sad to me, is like the whole thing with Kenyon Martin.
Right. That was this thing where you were doing all kinds of stuff to your hair, Jeremy, all these different styles. And you wore your hair in dreadlocks back in 2017. And Kenyon Martin, the former NBA player, popped up on Instagram to comment on that.
Do I need to remind this damn boy that his last name Lin? Come on, man. Let's stop this, man. These people, man. Like, like, there is no way possible, man, he would have made it on one of our teams, man, with that going on his head, man. Like, come on, man. Like, somebody really need to tell him, like, all right, bro, we get it. We get it. Like, you want to be black. Like, we get it.
When we talked about the hair and stuff like that, like, me and Kenyon Martin got a chance to talk about it over the phone, person to person, man to man. But what does Kenyon Martin still struggle with today, even on his social media, is he's receiving a lot of racist comments. And it's like, we're trying to undo racism, not promote more. And so let's say that, like, in a situation where I feel like I've been wronged, if I'm able to, you know, out somebody and then get quote unquote justice, does that help the elderly Asian American walking down the street? No, it does nothing. And that's who I'm concerned about.
So when you actually got a chance to meet with the player in question, what did you want accomplished? How did that meeting go?
I went well. I'm not going to get into the specifics. One thing that he said to me that was really cool was he said, look, like, you know, we've been in the bubble. We've been playing so much basketball. Like, I was unaware of all the things happening to Asian Americans. Like, I had no idea. And I was like, wow, like, that's amazing. Because not just him, I'm saying so many people said that to me in the G League bubble. Because it's really like, wow. you're playing, you know, 3 games every 5 days. And you're in this crazy, isolated, but like super hectic schedule. No one has time to do anything other than rest, recover, and get ready for the next game. And I can't tell you how many staff members, people I never met before, people I didn't know, opponents and my teammates, people that are just all coming up to me and saying, I had no idea this was happening to the Asian American community.
So, Jeremy, I want to get you off your soapbox here, finally, because I want to get into how you played in the G League bubble itself, because we had you on in November on this podcast. You very specifically talked about all the ways you were evolving your game. You described your jumper, which was going to be totally reworked from how it used to look, that catapult form, as you had called it. You described getting stronger, being more aggressive. And then you go out and you have this season in the G League where you shoot 43% from three. You take more than 5 threes a game. You average 20 points, 6 assists, 3 rebounds. Your percentages from the floor, 51 from the field, 43 from three, 88 from the free throw line. So how would you describe, looking back now, how would you describe your G League season?
I definitely thought it went well. I got it, you know, I finished 7th in the league in scoring.
Sutton, racing by his man. Back out to Lynn. Jeremy Lynn. It's Saturday night, Lynn Sanity.
And that's not what it's all about, but,
but it matters.
Every single person in the top 10 in scoring has an NBA contract except for me. So I think it's a matter of time. And then I was able to be 4th in the league in assists and the only player to shoot 50, 40, 85 out of all the players in the G League. And so in many ways, it's like in this situation, it just felt like everything came together. And the biggest thing for me, like the biggest way where I feel like I've grown is just mentally. Man, I'm playing free mentally. And again, a lot of that is from, you know, my faith and just getting to a place where I'm really just like, God, I'm giving you my best. I know who I am. Like, I don't need somebody else's validation or approval. Like, I know why I'm playing this game and I don't need to live and die with every shot that goes in or doesn't go in or every performance or game. And I think that allows me to be able to show more of who I am naturally.
I want to ask you also, Jeremy, at the very end here, because you had referenced this controversy before about your hair. And now I am watching you play basketball and your haircut is...
There's no haircut.
Majestic. It's majestic. No, it's majestic. And I think you can imagine why I particularly am into it. It's because that is what an Asian American like head looks like when you don't do anything to it. And I love it.
And that's funny because, you know, a lot of people were making fun of me. My friends and family were like, yo, what are you doing? Cut your hair. And I was like, no, because what do people see when they see me with that? Like, they're like, wow, you look so Asian. And I'm like, yeah, good. I want to look Asian. And then I'm going to go out there on the court and I'm going to do what I did and I'm going to play really well and I'm going to dominate. And then you're going to see somebody who looks really Asian and is Asian doing that on the court. And that's what I want you to see.
Jeremy, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for being a person that not just me, but I think a lot of people out there hopefully can relate to.
I appreciate that, Pablo. Thanks for having me and thanks for everything you do.
Up next, we switch to a very different tone and a bird of a very different feather.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Here's another story I want you to know. There are few pitchers as memorable as Randy Johnson. The dude had a mullet, a wildly explicit nickname, as well as 5 Cy Youngs, 10 All-Star appearances, 4,875 strikeouts, 1 no-hitter, and a perfect game. But when the big unit got elected to the Hall of Fame in 2015, he reflected on what baseball fans really want to talk about when they meet him.
You know, they don't come up and say, they don't talk about the Cy Youngs, and you know, they talk about the World Series. So what's that tell you? It's important to them too, so that's why it's so important to me. Well, they also talk about the dead pigeon too, but...
The pigeon in question met its infamous demise exactly 20 years ago today in a Diamondback spring training game against the Giants in a sort of proto-viral clip that you've probably seen many times, whether you're a baseball fan or not. But for the record here, that pigeon, as Johnson called it, wasn't actually a pigeon. Ornithologists have since concluded that the bird that collided with Randy Johnson's high 90s fastball in midair, completely randomly, must have been a mourning dove, which they could tell because of the unforgettable explosion of those white, downy feathers, which sounded at the time like this. In that video, and there is only one video in existence, you can see Johnson's catcher, Rod Barajas, jump back and to the right, completely freaked out at what had just happened. The batter at the plate, Calvin Murray, later admitted that he thought Johnson had just done some kind of exploding ball trick, maybe. But no. It was a dove, a mourning dove that had been flying from right to left before suddenly making contact with a Randy Johnson fastball, which otherwise takes less than half a second to reach home plate. The odds of this precise thing happening are so insane as to seem almost divine, or arguably the opposite, but in any case, eerily cosmic and truly existential, and also really hard to score. In fact, after huddling up on that afternoon in Tucson, the umpires wound up ruling the event they just witnessed a no pitch. So, even though it was one of the most famous pitches in human history, the demise of this dove was forever erased from the formal Major League Baseball universe. But not from our memories, where that bird still lives 20 years later. To this day. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.